ology. You know, you don't just want the problems to be covered. You want the whole story to be covered.
Exactly. And that actually is one of the areas where this story took a turn just a couple of years ago. When the Violence Against Women Act passed through Congress, at the very last second in the Senate, Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska was able to insert language that basically accepted Alaska from the entire law. The Alaska exemption, they called it. And she said she was doing it because she wanted to protect the one reservation in the state, not to stop the villages that want jurisdiction to stop them. But at any rate, it became law, and they had to undo it because everyone was so deeply offended by it. That said, now there's no process in part where the state and the tribes are negotiating to set up courts, to set up funding for violence against women. And like you said, the rates of violence are just so extraordinarily high in Alaska that this is an opportunity to actually fix a problem or solve a problem. In Alaska, the state is almost 30% Native, and yet the power to exercise that at the ballot has been an ongoing struggle. Many communities in Indian country are among the last to get the right to vote. Really, in the 1960s, it was still common to have positions of the state that prevented Native vote based on just who they were. So those kind of stories are just needing to be chronicled. But I think even more than that, you cannot understand this country without understanding the history and the participation today of Native people. It's part of the fabric. It's part of everything that makes up the country good and bad. And that's just been missing from the press discourse.
Well, we've been speaking with Mark Trahant. You can find more of his work online at trahantreports.com. He's a professor at the University of North Dakota. Mark Trahant, thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Glad to do it. Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 6:01, and next is Bread and Roses. Tonight, we'll listen to an interview with Jennifer Rountree about the hidden structure of violence, who benefits from global violence and war. Stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Elephant Revival, Thursday, September 10th at the Aladdin Theater in Portland. Elephant Revival is a five-piece band from Colorado that play folk music with gypsy, Celtic, and Americana influences. The show is originally scheduled for Revolution Hall, and all tickets for that show will be honored. Again, that's Elephant Revival, Thursday, September 10th, 10:30 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater, 3017 Southeast Milwaukee Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Let the fires burn tonight. Let the jugs of wine get drunk.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Oregon Black History Heroes and Legends, a three-day event from September 11th through 13th. The keynote speaker for this 20th anniversary celebration will be Mr. Les Pee Wee Harrison. And other speakers include Imani Muhammad, Mike Crenshaw, Jamo Greenidge, and more. That's Oregon Black History Heroes and Legends, September 11th through 13th at venues across Portland. Location, speakers, and more information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Aladdin Theater, presenting an evening with singer-songwriter Carla Bonoff, Friday, September 18th. Tickets and information for Carla Bonoff are available at aladdin-theater.com. And this KBOO program is also being made possible in part by KBOO Foundation member and a grant from People's Food Co-op, a community-owned, values-driven cooperative striving to provide access to whole foods customers can trust. People's features farm-direct organic produce, bulk foods, and weekly year-round farmers market, and everyone is welcome. Located on Southeast 21st and Tibet Street between Division and Powell. More information at peoples.coop.
at the dawn of the day. All the darkened kitchens, the mill of gray, all touched by the radiance that the sun discloses.
Welcome to Bread and Roses, feminist news and public affairs on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 FM. I'm Delphine Crescenzo. Tonight, I will be your host. Bread and Roses is a collective of women-identified radio activists. We give voice to those working for social justice and equity globally and locally. We strive to challenge systems of oppression. All this, and we have lots of fun. So just so you know, we always welcome new collective members. No experience necessary. So if you would like to find out more, you can contact KBOO Volunteers Coordinator. Her email is volunteer@kboo.org. Of course, you can like Bread and Roses on Facebook. We are KBOO Bread and Roses. There you can get updates and even behind-the-scenes photos. We are also on Twitter, and we tweet at Bread Roses Radio. You can also find us on the web, kboo.fm/breadandroses, to listen to past shows or even leave comments and suggestions. And you can also email us suggestions. Our email address is breadandrosescollective@gmail.com. Well, tonight on Bread and Roses, we talk about global structural violence with Jennifer Rountree, co-author with Mark Pilisuk of a new edition of the book called The Hidden Structure of Violence, Who Benefits from Global Violence and War? We'll discuss how violence is the result of our social order and, in fact, necessary to maintain that social order, despite the fact that most of us believe that violence in our world is inevitable or even a natural occurrence. Jennifer Rountree is research manager for the National Indian Child Welfare Association, also known as NICWA, in Portland, Oregon. She has a PhD in psychology from Saybrook Graduate School and Research Center in San Francisco, California. Her doctoral research featured a case study of one Maya community's process of self-determination in the context of current and historical social, economic, environmental, and political issues. She's written several peer-reviewed articles on community development, social justice, and cultural sovereignty for Indigenous communities, and she is the co-author of The Hidden Structure of Violence. Well, I sat with Jen earlier this week when she visited the KBOO studio, and in the first part of our conversation, Jen talks about the collaboration that gave life to the book and also shares some very grounding principles to help us be fully present as we move forward with this conversation about violence and its consequences. Jen Rountree, welcome.
Thank you
for being here. I'd love to start talking, your book, The Hidden Structure of Violence, Who Benefits from Global Violence and War? It really helps us to understand that even though we think that violence in our world is unavoidable and maybe a natural thing, violence, in fact, is really the result of our social order, and it is necessary to maintain the social order we already have. I was wondering if you can talk about, who's been involved in writing this book and how you've decided to write such a book, very comprehensive, mm-hmm. of the hidden structure of violence.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really have to share with you that my mentor, Dr. Mark Pilisuk, who was the co-author and primary author of this book, he's a professor of psychology. He's been a scholar and an activist for over 50 years now. Very esteemed author. He's written over 140 articles and 10 publications, but this is really a culmination of his life's work. Mm-hmm. He's spent many years in the field of peace and conflict resolution, social justice, poverty, and has written extensively about the influence of social networks in improving health outcomes. So what are the hidden community networks that we have in our everyday lives that really support us in our health, yeah. and well-being. So this is really a culmination of his life's work, and he's been honored through the Peace and Justice Studies Association, the Howards and Lifetime Achievement Award, Lifetime Achievement Awards from the study, or excuse me, the Society of the Psychological Study of Social Issues. So even though he's not a household name, he is he is a giant in the field of peace and social justice. Mm-hmm. But I came to work with him when I was in graduate school at Saybrook Graduate School and Research Center, which is a school in San Francisco, California. I was taking a number of courses from him, and he invited me to be his research assistant and supporting him in writing the first edition of this book, which came out a few years ago. But, you know, in the course of, I call it coming under the influence of Dr. Pilisuk at Saybrook, I started on a clinical track and then started taking his classes, and it just opened up. It was like a sea change for me, just mm-hmm. opened up this whole other world of social justice, and really helped me look at the world, you know, through the lens of psychology, but really looking at how, you know, these external environmental factors impact people's health and mental health. So, you know, when he invited me to help him in the research and writing of the first edition, I was, you know, completely overwhelmed with the opportunity. But in the course of working on it together, you know, he has, of course, numerous mentors in the field and colleagues that reviewed sections of the book, you know, help shape the text, help mm-hmm. give us, you know, helpful comments to shape the book. We had a lot of research assistants that helped with researching and editing various sections of the book. So lots mm-hmm. of support, and lots of support from Saybrook as well, I should mention. Mm-hmm. Lots of folks there were involved with the writing. But I just wanted to say that what I think makes the book really unique is that it examines violence not only in its direct forms, but also its structural forms, its more hidden, insidious mm-hmm. forms, and especially the scope of the book, because it, you know, it presents psychological theory about the human capacity for violence and war, in addition to describing, you know, these networks of power and how they operate to maintain and expand their power. Mm-hmm. So I think the fact that it brings those two things together, and in doing so, you know, each chapter provides case studies from, you know, the U.S., Central America, the Middle East, Asia, that in a really compelling way, I think, describe how these things impact individuals and communities on every day. Basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think such a timely book also, you know, as I'm listening to the news a lot around refugees, especially in Europe. I'm from southern France, mm-hmm. so it's really hitting home for me. I'm wondering, you know, the situation there and what's happening. And so, you know, as I was reading the book, I had that particular scenario mm-hmm. in mind of mm-hmm. what's happening with all these folks just flooding the Mediterranean and dying in the process.
That's right.
And lots of European countries saying, we need to send them back.
Right. What do we do?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I thought that the book was very helpful for me in understanding better what's happening with that situation. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you set the tone already in the introduction, and there's five things that you ask the reader to commit to as they move forward. And so, I was wondering if we can share those with the listener also, as I feel like there might be just good guidelines. For the listeners also, we keep in mind as we start delving a little deeper mm-hmm. into those different things. Could you detail the 5 points and explain a little bit about the rationale behind each of them?
Sure. So the first one is, I'll just read these. Face up to the disturbing facts about the forms of global violence, and remind yourself that these numbers reflect real human lives. So I think the point is really, you know, it's easy to become overwhelmed by statistics, but we have to remember that these are people, these are children, these are families, these are grandparents and aunts and uncles. I'm a qualitative researcher, so I, you know, a lot of times like to say, I don't like statistics. I want to know the story behind the numbers. But, you know, you've heard of the term collateral damage or externalities. And this is, you know, supports the idea that conflict is inevitable and loss of lives should be expected.
Mm-hmm.
So this is just really to remember as we overwhelm you with statistics in this very well-researched book, I think, to remember that these are people that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The next two I'm going to read together because I think they're really closely connected. But the second one is, refrain from demonizing those most central to the promotion of this violence. And number three is, the book names people and organizations, but the task is not to blame, but to understand the system in which global violence has become a central part. So I guess the point is here is that although we are identifying people and organizations that are central to this structure of violence, the purpose is not to blame or demonize them, but this we have to identify them in the process of uncovering mm-hmm. what they're doing. But this is really about understanding, so we can start, you know, for one, approaching our leadership and starting to be able to hold them accountable, and also to find, you know, alternative structures that support, you know, sustainable, peaceful ways of living.
Mm-hmm.
Another is retain the hope that deeper understanding will contribute to empowering each of us in what we do to create a world of peace. So this is about, you know, hope and looking towards the future. And I think it's, you know, it's important to be realistic about what we're up against as, you know, peacemakers and how we each approach that in our own way. But I think whatever our role or position in the work that we do, we have opportunities to do what we do with integrity and to support equity, whether it's racial equity or economic equity mm-hmm. in everything that we do. The last one is grapple with this book in doses that fit your needs and find antidotes for the violence in caring, contact with people, and the renewing powers of meditation, reflection, exercise, music, art, food, laughter, and the beauty of the land. Then, if any of this restorative bounty is worth preserving, come back to grapple with the violence that threatens our world and your place in securing the future. So I really, there's a couple things about this. I think one, it's important and helpful not to be motivated by anger or fear, but by, you know, a real ethic of care. And how can we protect and support those things that we value and love? You know, is it worth protecting? Of course, mm-hmm. absolutely. You know, in the work that I do now, I work with a lot of social workers and working with Native communities, we talk a lot about trauma mm-hmm. and secondary trauma mm-hmm. And just how important it is in doing the work that we do of the importance of taking care of ourselves. So it's, you know, in order to care for others, we really have to learn how to take care of ourselves first. Mm-hmm. I think that's really important.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for all of these. I think that they were very helpful in grounding me, and especially this last one. I just very much cherish, right, the self-care piece, but also, you know, where does the desire to fight comes from? It comes from wanting to protect all these things that make us feel good about right. who we are.
Exactly.
About the world. You are listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo, and tonight we are listening to an interview that I conducted earlier this week with Jen Rountree about a book that she co-authored entitled The Hidden Structure of Violence: Who Benefits from Global Violence and War. The book really helps us understand that even though we may think that the violence in our world is unavoidable and even a natural thing, well, violence is in fact the result of our social order and necessary to maintain that social order, is what the book demonstrates. Well, in the second part of our conversation, Jen discusses the cultural beliefs that really allow the global pattern of violence to continue every day. This is her take.
I think, you know, especially in this country, this is a story that we've been repeatedly told, mm-hmm. you know, that the human capacity for violence makes war inevitable. In the second chapter of the book, we talk about various psychological theories about this and the motivation for humans to be aggressive and kill other humans. We talk about how, you know, humans are distinguished by being the only species with the capacity to kill large numbers of their own kind.
Yes.
But also to have symbolic representations of reality. And we talk about how those things, you know, may be connected. And, you know, in doing so, about, you know, symbols that we use to categorize ourselves, identify ourselves as nations or religions or groups. And when taken to the extreme, how we use, you know, like the mechanism of projection to project all those things that we don't like about our own group and culture and nation onto other people. So, of course, there's lots of examples of this. But, you know, we talk also about how, you know, for especially people who've been traumatized and feel really insecure, like, you know, there's a tendency to, you know, curse, belittle, blame, bully other people, but rarely does it get to the extent that you're really harming other people with, mm-hmm. with serious physical violence. So what is it that really makes, you know, distinguishes that trait? You know, I think we try to make the point in the book that the willingness to kill is something that has to be learned, just like, and, you know, not very different from how empathy also has to be learned. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, there's a lot of different psychological theories about this. I personally do believe that there is a real human capacity for violence, that, you know, there is evil in the world. And I think for that very reason that we need human institutions like human rights commissions, et cetera, that hold us accountable, mm-hmm. Protect us from each other. But, you know, we also talk about the creation of soldiers and the, you know, the creation of what makes a killer. And we talk about how the dehumanization process is so critical to becoming a soldier. There's a story in the book about in World War II, on Christmas Eve, there was a group of Nazi and American soldiers that, you know, put down their weapons from the night and got together and had dinner and drank and smoked and partied all night. And the next day, when their commanders found out about it, they were absolutely irate because they knew that the next day it was going to be so much harder to go out there and you know, kill their enemy. That's now they were friends. Mm-hmm. So, anyway.
Yeah, what a powerful story that shows both, right? Like how it's learned
right.
In one way or the other.
Right.
Right. You can learn to be have compassion after you meet people and get to be with them, but then also you can learn to kill them.
That's right. And there's another study that we reference in the book as well. Just briefly, it's a study of Nazi stormtroopers. And what's really interesting about it is, you know, here they committed the most incredible atrocities. But the study revealed that, you know, day to day, on the outside, they look like really normal people. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, it just helps demonstrate that we're all capable of violent behavior, and it's the circumstances, the obedience to authority that we may fall victim to that brings that out in us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that piece. And so I'm wondering if we can start, talking a little bit about how you kind of lift this veil, right? Because you start with the very obvious physical violence. You start by talking about war, and then you go into this psychology of how we are even able to be okay with this. But then chapter after chapter, you reveal intentional policies, media manipulation, psychological warfare, really the capitalist gain, all of this being at the heart of global violence. Could you describe how you do that?
Well, I think it's helpful to define what we mean when we say violence. Mm-hmm. So the way we define it is quite broadly. So any activity that increases the suffering of others is violence. Mm-hmm. And you know, we didn't come up with this definition. This is, you know, from the field of peace studies, but Johann Galtung, who is the founder of peace studies, defined violence as avoidable insults to basic human needs. So it goes far beyond, you know, physical acts or physical events of violence, which we call direct violence, but is also structural, what we call structural violence. So these are policies and institutions that prevent people from meeting their basic needs. So, you know, I think a great example of this are the subsidization of industrial agriculture in this country, which makes it possible for a person living in a Japanese village to buy rice from the U.S. at a cost that is less than from their own neighbor. But this, we spend, quite a bit of emphasis on, you know, identifying what are these more hidden forms of violence, the structural violence. So we offer a lot of case examples of the impact of global economic policies, you know, be it free trade, manufacturing, the lack of labor protections for workers, the growing wealth disparity in this country. Mm-hmm. In another chapter, we focus on the impact of corporate forces on our land, water. So really talking about the globalization of food production, biotechnology, the privatization of water. Beyond that, in subsequent chapters, we talk about networks of power. And this is really building on Dr. Pilisak's earlier work on game theory, which is all about strategic decision making. But it's really a network analysis of the web of organizations and individuals that together maintain and expand their influence. So, for example, we talk about the military industrial link and how those two entities provide mutual benefit. Mm-hmm. But also about how the clubs of the elite. So we talk about like the Order of Skull and Bones, the Bilderberg Group, and others. That really create those deep personal ties among the elite. So these are, the sort of premier people in the worlds of financing, politics, business, academia. So these are incredible networking opportunities, really, for these people at an international level. But we also talk about how think tanks, advisory boards, and councils, you know, like, for example, the Council on Foreign Relations, as well as international groups. So how these groups have a role in planning and implementing policy. So, all these sort of groups have a special role to play and have something to gain in their relationships with each other. So, you know, this isn't a vast conspiracy, but this is how power works. Mm-hmm. You know, this is how it's created and maintained, this, you know, system of interconnected military and corporate elites that really affect the use and distribution of resources. But, you know, in talking about, you know, how is, you know, we look at what they're doing, like, how is it possible that they can get away with these things? So we also talk about how the media plays an important role.
Yeah.
So, and we look at historical examples of propaganda. So the Committee on Public Information that was so critical to the U.S. public support for the First World War, you know, this is strategy, right? This is really thinking through how can we win over the hearts and minds of the people? Mm-hmm. So it's very, very planful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we also look at how our own collective myths in this country also help perpetuate the system. So, you know, we talk about American exceptionalism.
Mm.
So this myth that the U.S. is a special land of equal opportunity, when we see examples, you know, every day that's not the case for everyone. That, you know, this country's built on a history of slavery and segregation and racism that's still very much alive and well today, you know, unfortunately. And we've used the most destructive weapons against people, the atomic bomb. You know, we have a real sense of moral superiority, but, you know, when you look at statistics, health statistics, you know, we have poor infant mortality rates compared to a lot of countries. We have a real problem with poverty in this country, food insecurity, and we have the greatest number of incarcerated people in the world. So I think it's important to talk about, you know, where does this moral superiority come from, and what do we need to do to maintain that sense of superiority? And also, one of my favorite myths is the belief in the moral rightness of competitive individualism. So this is all about the self-made person, right?
Why is this one your favorite?
Yeah, this one is my favorite because this is the one that always comes up in the Republican speeches. This is the one that's all about the success is always attributed to their own, you know, attributes and efforts, and they worked hard and they pulled themselves up by their bootstraps, and that whole story that you've heard a million times, that I've heard a million times. Where on the flip side of that is everyone who is poor or is struggling is poor and struggling because they're not working hard enough, for example. There's something wrong with them. They're deficient in some way. Not that the system is, you know, making it difficult for them. So it's really, it's focused on the individual instead of the system.
Yeah, and I feel also it's saying to the folks that are successful that they've done it on their own, when in fact they have not. Right?
No.
And there's been the system in place for them to be able to do that. But there's more than that. There's also the folks on the other side maybe who are suffering so that he can make more, right?
That's right.
So, yeah, very hidden.
Yeah.
I was wondering if we can talk a little bit about modern warfare, because I think that it's one of the most obvious forms of violence that our governments are involved in. And so very often people are familiar with the consequences of war, but not always of all the consequences. So I was wondering if you can talk a little bit about how really is war affecting, is affecting our society, especially in the U.S., because we are masters of war.
Yes, absolutely. And the 20th century was the bloodiest in all of human history. The U.S. is both the largest beneficiary of global inequality and the world's specialist in weapons technology. So overseas weapon sales by the U.S. is the majority of the global arms market. It makes up roughly three quarters of the arms market. So it's safe to say that it's a big business.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's safe to say.
Safe to say. And the U.S. defense budget, you know, we know is by far the largest in the world. So, you know, more than the next, I think, dozen countries combined, and more than six times the next on the list, which I think is China, which we're always criticizing China about how militaristic they are, which is... but
it's a strategy.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's a strategy. You know, so of course, the defense industry has exponentially grown with a handful of contractors repeatedly winning no-bid contracts for billions of dollars. But the argument is that technological advances in modern warfare saves lives, like the use of smart weapons like drones and delivery systems that you know save the number of human lives lost, and also, you know, resolve a conflict quickly and in a shorter period of time. We all have observed that neither of these things are true.
Yeah.
You know, technology has in fact made larger scale violence possible. So, and the use of, you know, drones and modern weapons that include, you know, chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons are more likely to cause irreversible damage than weapons that we've ever had before. So the reach and the level of destruction are much greater. And, you know, as you mentioned, the refugees coming into Southeast Europe, you know, private security companies, child soldiers, militant bands, you know, seeking revenge through acts of terror. These are all the sort of the new players in modern warfare. And then looking at our soldiers, they're disproportionately from communities of color and from low-income families. A lot of them, you know, might be seeking access to higher education. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how different would it be if our, you know, senators' sons and daughters, if they were going to be putting them into harm's way, what would our policies look like? But, you know, in terms of the safety argument that we always hear about weapons technology, nearly half of the veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan are seeking compensations for injuries they received, you know, while serving. So this is a much greater number than even the soldiers that claimed injuries in the Gulf War just, you know, 20-some years ago. So the smart weapons aren't keeping our soldiers safe. And then there's just, you know, on a greater scale, the culture of violence that we have, you know, the martial values that we have. Problems are solved with violence, and we look at diplomacy as a weakness in this country.
And so the million-dollar question, so who benefits from the global violence? Because that's in part what the book answers. There's this hidden structure, and then who benefits from it?
I think, you know, the simple answer is that the entities that profit from it. So, you know, again, we identify many of these individuals and entities in the book, but, you know, heads of state, former heads of state that have close and even direct ties to the, you know, the biggest corporations in the defense industry or to international governing bodies that create the policies that condone these actions and you know, don't permit developing countries and communities protect their own natural resources. But this is how networks of power are maintained and expanded. You know, we identify groups that are responsible for creating the policy directives both within and outside of government that make the plans for war, the business advocacy and lobbying groups that help shape the policy environment. So we're all familiar with the NRA, the National Rifle Association, but not many people are as familiar with the National Association of Manufacturers. But they represent over 100,000 companies. It's the nation's largest industrial trade association, and they're incredibly influential. So this is, you know, primarily labor policies, international policy.
So they're probably behind the TPP and the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Absolutely. They have everything to benefit from that. You know, other plan makers, I mentioned the Project for the New American Century, but they were very clear about their objectives, about where they wanted to take the U.S. So they wanted really to dominate in global affairs. But what makes them such a striking example is how clearly they influenced pushing the U.S. to war with Iraq.
Mm.
But also, it's just really striking about who their members are. Mm. You know, it really reads like a roster of the G.W. Bush administration. So all of these members, you know, have ties to the oil and defense industries. So they have absolutely everything to gain mm-hmm. from the U.S. going to war with Iraq. So again, you know, of course, I'm not giving it all away here because no. I want you to read the book.
Yes.
But it, the purpose is not, you know, to vilify these people. But I think it's helpful in seeing how these different groups work together. In various ways, how they benefit from one another's work and actions, and that they're motivated by profit. So this isn't always about democracy and freedom mm-hmm. like we hear about. This is about making money.
Sacred fires lifted up like holy hands. Understand there's something wrong. There's trouble on the land.
Crystal falls. You're listening to Baran Rizas. I'm Delphine Crescenzo, and this is Ani Humphrey, 500 Years of Genocide. Well, tonight we are listening to an interview that I conducted earlier this week with Jen Rountree about a book that she co-authored entitled The Hidden Structure of Violence, Who Benefits from Global Violence and War? Really, the book is trying to help us understand that even though we may think violence in our world is inevitable, a natural occurrence, violence is in fact the result of our social order and in fact necessary for maintaining the social order that is already in place. Well, in this final part of the conversation with Jen, I asked her, Jen Rountree, to explain how the ecological crisis really relates to global structural violence. And this is her answer.
Well, so Joseph Stiglitz, who's the Nobel Prize-winning economist, he not too long ago identified, you know, the ecological crisis as the social justice issue of our time. Like, mm-hmm. this is the most critical social justice issue of our generation, because it's oftentimes those nations that contribute the least, you know, to human-driven climate change processes that are the ones most negatively impacted yeah. by them. So, you know, places like little small island countries like the Solomon Islands in the South Pacific that are, you know, literally going underwater, to places like the Arctic, where the geography is literally, you know, shifting. The land masses are yeah. are changing. But in general, you know, climate change is I think most profoundly felt by land-based communities, so people that rely on the land for their day-to-day existence. I spent some time in Guatemala, and but I went there on two different occasions to study community development. But on both times that I went, just prior to coming there, they had been hit really hard by hurricanes, and just seeing how just completely upside down their world was after that. In one case, a community that I worked with on Lake Atitlan, they had lost part of the town that it had just completely gone, you know, was covered up by a landslide. So this is a real visceral reality that people are dealing with. But, you know, the failure to acknowledge that this is happening despite all the very clear and decisive scientific research that demonstrates that it's happening, you know, it just clearly demonstrates that they're interests that have a lot to lose in changing, you know, changing the technologies. You know, business interests are trump the importance of care for the planet. You know, they're sort of glorified as job creators. Like, yeah, that's the most important thing in the world, you know. and they criticize, you know, new technologies that they're too expensive, they're inefficient. But, you know, obviously the people who are saying those things have a lot to lose.
Mm-hmm. So now let's talk about, you know, maybe more uplifting things. And so I'd love it. You know, at one point you really acknowledged the importance of alternative media mm-hmm. such as Democracy Now. I'm hoping KBOO Community Radio as
Absolutely.
Well. Yeah. Talk about the importance of what's available, the information that's made available by alternative media. That was also very helpful in writing the book.
Yeah, it really did play a critical role in writing the book. And you know, so much news nowadays is not news. It's sound bites. It's celebrity gossip. It's very carefully scripted. It's entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in researching this book, you know, I learned that in 1983, 50 companies owned 90% of American media. And as of just a few years ago, 90% was controlled by just 6 corporations. So including, you know, GE, for example, mm-hmm. that owns NBC, and Disney that owns ABC. So, you know, there's this myth of the liberal media. The right always talks about the liberal media. There is no liberal media. I mean, it doesn't exist. And I know this is something that if you're familiar with Robert McChesney, I'm sure you are. Mm-hmm. He's written so much about democracy and media criticism. But I know he turned us on to a survey by the Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting organization, FAIR, which found that 75% of investigated journalists and editors surveyed in TV news admitted that advertisers had tried to influence the content of their stories. And 60% felt pressure from their own stations to produce news stories simply to please the advertiser. So an incredible impact. And, you know, I was thinking just recently about the kayaktivists
mm-hmm. Who were
on
right
the
here.
St. John's Bridge, yeah, in our little town in Portland, Oregon. But in watching that, I was really struck by how poorly the local news covered them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and not to pick on the local news, but, you know, they first of all, they didn't let them tell their story. They didn't ask them why they were doing what they were doing. They seemed very concerned, like, with sort of the silly stuff, like, how are you suspended from the bridge, and how, and when are you going to sleep, and when are you going to eat? And I felt like it was all about this completely, you know, really kind of belittling what they were doing and turning it into, like, some sort of freak show or something. I mean, although, you know, as a whole, it brought incredible attention to the activities of Shell and the purpose that they were there for. But I think it was an example of how not living up to what we want journalism and need journalism mm-hmm. to do for us. But, you know, again, you know, alternative media is really what helped us shape a lot of what's in the book. And it, you know, it's informing you, obviously, about what's really going on in the world. The other day, I was really grateful to read a story about what's going on in Guatemala right now, which is, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the story, but their current president, Otto Perez Molina is his name, but he and his administration have been charged with corruption, mm-hmm. And are facing impeachment. And it's really an incredible thing if you know anything about the history of this country. And this is a president who was once a field commander during mm-hmm. the 36-year civil war in Guatemala. And he and, you know, all his cronies have really had incredible immunity to protect them. But, you know, thanks to, you know, international organizations and human rights organizations, they, you know, the courts there are starting to have a little more teeth mm-hmm. And are starting to make some real changes. So I would not hear about this story on the Today Show, for example. I would not hear about this on the evening news. So we rely on, you know, public radio, mm-hmm. Alternative radio to bring us, you know, the stories of what's really happening in the world,
really
not get hung up on what crazy things Donald Trump's saying today or whatever.
Which, you know, there will always be something.
There will always be something. You see his comic relief, I suppose.
Yeah. What are some people doing out there to try to change the paradigm, help us move towards peace? And I was wondering if you could share, you know, especially about the World Social Forum. I think it's a very good collaborative, you know, international effort, but you can share about whatever else.
Well, first of all, the World Social Forum. So this started in Brazil in the early 2000s, but it's a forum for all kinds of change makers and peacemakers to share what they're doing in their communities, whether it's they work with NGOs or their nonprofit organizations, health organizations, economic development projects. The purpose of it is not to just say, hey, look at the great things we're doing, but the point is to really combine forces. And mm-hmm. don't want to use the word forces, but you know, but to really link together and to coordinate our efforts maybe towards, you know, making real change. And it's an international group. I think the next one is in Montreal next August. Mm-hmm. An international wealth of ideas and opportunity for exchange. I think it is so exciting that there are so many examples of efforts around, you know, here locally, but around the world. And I just, you know, I wanted to share that Dr. Pilisag put out just a couple years ago a really comprehensive anthology. He worked on it with Michael Nagler, who's the founder of the Peace and Conflict Studies program at UC Berkeley, but they've done a lot of work together. Mm-hmm. But it's called Peace Movements Worldwide. Mm, so it's a three-volume set. But it's literally an encyclopedia of projects that are currently happening around the globe. And in one of the volumes, you know, they do more than talk about the projects. They really break down what makes certain movements successful mm-hmm. and how they sustain themselves and what sets them apart. So it's much more informative than I could ever begin to tell you in this, you know, brief interview. But I really encourage your listeners, if they're interested, to seek out mm-hmm. That work, because it's an incredible body of work and speaks to what's happening right now. Mm-hmm. And you know, again, one of the movements that I'm, you know, really excited about is food sovereignty. Mm-hmm. Although I don't currently work in that field now, but it's When I was in Central America, there were a lot of projects really taking off. But now it's taking off in Indian country, so mm-hmm. it's exciting to see it here, mm-hmm. you know, closer to home.
Mm-hmm. And so how about individuals? What do you think individuals can do to work towards peace in their life and around them?
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, I certainly don't see myself as an expert who can really, you know, maybe fully answer this question. But I think that, you know, when we look at psychological theory, for example, and we talk about adulthood, it's not actually about amassing wealth and influence. It's about social responsibility and contributing to the greater good. Like that's what makes you
an adult.
A big person. Yeah. I know that, you know, personally in my own role as I like to consider myself a change maker. I think that my work at NICWA is really fulfilling, and that we do a lot of projects that center on supporting the development of cultural identity in Native kids, mm-hmm. Because it has an incredible impact on their health and well-being. Just the simple, mm-hmm. I feel good about where I come from and who I am and who mm-hmm. my parents are and who my grandparents are. And a really profound way of supporting health and healing for Native people. So I really value having the opportunity to work for NICWA and go out to communities and see what mm-hmm. they're doing and support them. But I think we all have a special role to play in whatever we're doing. You know, there's a lot at stake, and I think that we've seen how, you know, racial and ethnic tensions, you know, will just become greater as, you know, we need scapegoats, we need a rationale for mm-hmm. this, you know, these forms of violence and oppression. So I think it's so important to have forums like this one, to have yeah. public radio, to have programs like this program, so we can connect with one another and support each other.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Thank
Jen
you.
Rontree,
I really
for taking
appreciate
the
it.
Time. You're listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo. And so tonight I played an interview that I conducted this week with Jennifer Rontree about the book that she co-authored entitled The Hidden Structure of Violence, Who Benefits from Global Violence and War. And you can find out more about the book and order it online at www.monthlyreview.org. That's monthlyreview.org. You can like Bread and Roses on Facebook to get updates and see behind-the-scenes photos. Also, we are on Twitter at Bread Roses Radio. Also find us on the web, kboo.fm/Bread and Roses, to listen to past show, even leave comments or show ideas. And also you can email us suggestions. Our email address is breadandrosescollective@gmail.com. We are a collective of women-identified radio activists at Bread and Roses, and we bring you feminist news and public affairs every Friday on KBOO. Well, next week, stay tuned. Zoe Pelliafis will be your host. And next week will be an incredible opportunity for you, dear listeners, to support your community radio station and to support this program, Bread and Roses, ongoing for 37 years with KBOO and its members, that's you, making feminist perspective a priority on the airwaves. So we are incredibly thankful for that. And we hope that you will show your support. However, if you donate early, which is in between now and next Thursday, we will shorten the membership drive, but also you will get a chance to enter to receive amazing thank yous, and that's only if you donate before. So if you are interested in finding more, you can go to kboo.org.
And you will find this information on the front page. Well, have a great week, everyone. And I'm going to leave you with, let's see, what did I pick? It's already playing. This is Going Home. And this is... this is Ulali. Thank you.
Return their prayers that run through my veins. Return the land and heal her pain. The hidden truth. Tell the world the blues where it comes from. Under the earth, blood of Skaruda Nation was free. I hear Nigerian chains, they say, are buried real deep. Tobacco fields, trail of tears, stolen people on stolen land. I'm going home.
You just listened to Bread and Roses coming at you right here at 90.7 FM KBOO Portland. Hello, my name's Mr. Hemi Blue Rhino, sitting in with you on a lovely Friday. It is Davey D and the boys, and it's a Hard Knock Radio that's going to be coming at you next for your Friday. And then after that, it's the 1212 Friday.